Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Since 1959, Toastmasters' most prestigious award, the Golden Gavel, has been presented annually in August at the Toastmasters International Convention to an individual distinguished in the fields of communication and leadership. The amazing list of Golden Gavel honorees include names such as Dr. Joyce Brothers, Walter Cronkite, Stephen Covey, Tony Robbins, Lisa Sun, Matt Abrahams, Julian Treasure, Zig Ziglar, and many more. And this year, we have the honor of speaking with the 2026 recipient, Jennifer Moss. Jennifer Moss is an award-winning international speaker, journalist, author, and workplace culture strategist. Moss strategized with leadership teams at large enterprise firms to measure well-being and improve organizational culture and performance. She's a former member of the Global Happiness Council in partnership with Gallup and the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, and a contributor to its annual Global Happiness Policy Report, which truly makes me smile. Why Are We Here is her third leadership book focused on workplace culture and wellness. Her previous book, The Burnout Epidemic, was named by Thinkers 50 as one of the 10 best new management books of 2022 and shortlisted for the Outstanding Works of Literature Awards. Unlocking Happiness at Work was also named a Business Book of the Year in the United Kingdom. If that's not enough, Jennifer is also a nationally syndicated radio columnist, co-host of the podcast, How to Change Culture in 20 Minutes or Less. Jennifer's research and insights are regularly featured in Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and Fortune. Jennifer has also been recognized as a Canadian Innovator of the Year, an International Female Entrepreneur of the Year, and received a Public Service Award from the Office of Former President Barack Obama. Jennifer's profile by Stephanie Darling is featured in the May 2026 edition of the Toastmaster magazine. It's entitled Golden Gavel Recipient Jennifer Moss Champions Workplace Wellbeing. The 2026 honoree highlights hope and gratitude as life essentials. Coming to us today from just outside Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Jennifer Moss, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Thank you. I am so delighted to be with all of you, and I can't wait to see everyone in August that's going to be there in Vancouver.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations, Jennifer. And to kick things off, what went through your mind when you got the call, and what does this mean to you?
This is a really great question because it's so special to me. You know, when I was growing up, being a writer was my goal. And there is a time capsule where I've written that I'm going to be an author and I was going to win the Newbery Prize Award, which is funny because I'm Canadian and you cannot win the Newbery Prize for literature because you have to be American. But I still had big goals. And that was what I was going to do. I was going to write, which I did. I accomplished that, but I was never going to be a speaker. You know, I was one of those people that would have chosen every other option, like, you know, death before getting on stage. I was so terrified. Through a bunch of circuitous career paths and landing myself on the TEDx stage, I was like, this is a one-time thing. I'm only going to do this once. And here I am so much later, and it's been an effort, and it's practice, and it's a huge amount of nerves and terror and fear, and then finally getting good enough to feel like you have mastery over it. And now I love it, and it's everything I want to do. So this award to me is extra special. It's not like the awards that I've received for my books aren't special, but there's something about getting awarded for something that you never thought you were good at. It just feels extra nice to get this recognition.
That's awesome. The profile, of course, it's quite enlightening and eye-opening. And you mentioned right away being a terrified public speaker, and that's brought up right away in the article. And immediately it goes to quote that the memory of your first speech is so strong that I reacted viscerally to it. As Toastmasters, this is just pure gold. So Jennifer, if you wouldn't mind, take us back to that moment of your first speech, and why is it 14 years later you still react to it the way that you do?
This was a request from a friend who was running the TEDx event, and she said, you have a story to tell. I think it's really important for you to to join and to talk about your experience of, you know, why you got into becoming a happiness expert and how do people become a happiness expert? I mean, what is that even? And especially at the time, that was still pretty avant-garde. And she said, you have to do it. And I said, 100%, absolutely no way. Like, no, thank you. No. And she pushed me. She kept saying, you have to do this. Like, step outside of your comfort zone. This is what you do. You know, go for it. And I said no for a long time. And then finally, I thought, you are not really living up to the model that you want to set for your girls. You have to go do this. It's just one time. You'll just really prepare. And I prepared, I practiced, I still got there and threw up multiple times. I sat in the bathroom telling myself in the mirror, you know, you've got this. I was calling myself a beast, like going like, you're a beast. And I was doing power poses in the mirror. And then I heard this soft knock on the door where I realized that everyone outside had been listening to me in the bathroom, giving myself a pep talk, which was so embarrassing. But I just had to get outside, put on my big girl pants and get on that stage and do it. I got out there and I was nervous, and you can even tell by the video that I was nervous, but it went fine. People were kind to me. They wanted me to be successful, and I got through it, and preparation helped. And I realized, okay, that was a big milestone, a fear that I had overcome. But I did think it was going to be done, and I was just going to do it that one time. And then other, you know, opportunities kept coming up, and I thought, okay, well, I'll do it again and again. And then now here I am. But it was painful. And I think we talked about this before, Greg, where I said, I wish I had Toastmasters to give me a little bit of practice in a safe space versus me just putting myself in a sink or swim situation.
So when you do come across that, you said you react viscerally. What happens like right now?
I still get that feeling in my chest of, I think it's healthy anxiety now. It's not abject fear. It's like good nerves. It's getting me ready so that I can do something that I really care about and do it well. So there's a healthy amount of nerves because it does mean, that I care about it. And I want to do a really good job for people in the audience, and I want to connect with them, and I care about the topic. I'm really passionate about what I talk about. That also is important. I want to get it across to people. I want people to leave with something valuable and tangible. You know, that's why I get the nerves now, but I'm not afraid to get up on stage. A big part of that is just having a real mastery of your content. I know what I'm talking about in this space with so much depth. I'm so connected to the topic and the content that it really helps, because it's like I'm going up there and talking about something that I love and is meaningful and I know is impactful. And that's what I say to people is talk about what you love, talk about what you know, and know it really well. And then it's just, you know, talking about, like, to your brother about something you just learned on. Yeah, it really can get that comfortable if you know what you're talking about.
The speech was entitled The Epidemic of Smiles and the Science of Gratitude. And we'll certainly put a link to that in the show notes, because everyone, you have to watch this. You have to see it. I remember you talking about turning the trait of happiness into the state of happiness.
Yes, this is a funny thing too. When I was up on that stage, and everyone will get a kick out of that, it's actually backwards. You go from having a state of happiness to it becoming a trait. And every time I watch that video and watch that back, I just cringe, like, oh, you got that backwards, because I was so nervous. It's one of those, you know, moments where it's like, okay, that definitely was the first time I was out there. But the whole idea of practicing gratitude, for example, it's a psychological trait that helps us to focus on what we have versus what we don't have. Well, you practice gratitude and you have states of being grateful. But when it becomes a trait, it means that you are a grateful person and you've moved from that state of practice to actually becoming that thing. And it's your persona. And a lot of what I talk about is micro shifts in the neuroplasticity of our behaviors that become habits end up becoming traits. It becomes who we are. You don't just build that without practice. We tend to think, you know, you're born empathetic or you're not, or you're born grateful or you're not, or it's very much a more of a genetic predisposition. But you can learn and develop the skills of empathy if you practice it. You can also practice maladaptive behaviors that aren't very pro-social and that makes you meaner or less kind. We can practice to be good people or practice to not be so good.
You know how sometimes you have a sentence and the words are out of alignment, but yet you still get the message? I think this is the case here, because maybe the words were backwards or not stated in the right order, but I think I got the message.
Yeah, that is key, because so much of the other content, you know, in the talk was really alluding to this idea of the practice makes perfect, right? And so you did get the message, but I do laugh so, like, every time I look at it, I think, wow, you've come so far. Your nerves aren't tricking your brain into mixing things up, which is really good. That's very helpful. So, you know, they say 87% of stats are made up, and that is the risk when you go up there and you are as evidence-based as I am. I really believe in the science. I think that that's really important to make sure that you get it across, that this is practical and you feel it in your gut and you know it, but you have data to back it up. This push like I have, or this focus or desire to really be evidence-backed, you have to know your stuff. So nerves obviously get in the way of that. And I'm glad that I don't have that issue as much anymore, because, you know, it does make it trickier to get all of the things you want to get out in a talk when you are feeling happy up on stage and not stressed out.
We're talking about statistics. What are the chances that I pulled out that one thing?
Right. No, but I think it's perfect for this conversation, because it really is, you know, it is about building your skills and realizing that you are going to make mistakes. And even as much as you practice, it's not about perfection. It's really more about getting your message across and having people connect to what you're saying. And anytime I would script myself, it was just a total bust. I'm not good at having a script. I have to know something really well and be able to talk about it informally, so that when I get up on stage, that I'm not stuck to, if one, you know, data point is lost or one part of a sentence is missing, that I fall apart. And so I think that that's important to recognize, is you just want to be able to talk about this informally. So when you get up on stage, it is really just so much easier. And I do find that scripts can sometimes catch us off guard. And when that happens, I feel like it can derail very quickly.
That's a good thing to remember, is think about it like you're talking to your brother or a friend across the table. That's great. The Smile Epidemic blog, how did that come about? Tell us a little bit about that.
This was a project from my husband's brain, which is really cool. He was playing pro lacrosse in California. He's a pro athlete. He is a very high-performing pro athlete. He's in the Canadian Lacrosse Hall of Fame, the California Lacrosse Hall of Fame. He's a coach. He's won multiple gold medals. And he became acutely paralyzed from what they think was Guillain-Barré syndrome as he was planning to return for his lacrosse season. It was just this whole whirlwind of events that we went from, is he going to make it through the night? Is he going to ever walk again? You know, is he going to walk in a year? He walked out of the hospital after 6 weeks. He really looked at that as this psychological fitness that athletes get. And we really go to sports psychology when we're talking about leadership and leadership development, which I think is really interesting that we do that. But it's because as an athlete, you get this coaching, you're high performing, you're working as a team, you develop all these special skills, and it's identified early in life. So you get this training very early in your development. A lot of people don't get that. You know, there's only about 5% of the entire world, maybe even less than that, that get to play sports and get paid for it. Most people are not getting this kind of development. And when he got sick, he kept just focusing on being nice to people and kind and grateful. And he found that people around him were more supportive. They were giving extra time. He was getting more PT, like physical therapy and occupational therapy. And he believes that was a big part of why he healed so much quicker than maybe his grouchy neighbor in the other bed that was, you know, constantly complaining and was unhappy and miserable and didn't take the help. For him, he went on to say, I think we need to understand that other people need to focus on some of these core skills and build the skills. And one of them was gratitude. So he started the Smile Epidemic, which was a Tumblr blog. And then it ended up going like over to 100 countries. It was unbelievable how many responses he got back. But basically you would just take a piece of paper and you would draw a smile on it and you would write what you were grateful for. And you would post it as a picture to this blog, the Smile Epidemic. The things we would hear and get from even children, like children would be grateful for having a house that they could finally live in where they got to share a bedroom with their brother instead of all having to share it in the living room. And, you know, just basic, simple stuff that make you realize how privileged you are and how lucky you are and how you need to be grateful for what you have. And it was just a beautiful project that translated into a lot of, I think, really impacted our decision about what we wanted to do next with our career, but it did really bake in a sense of gratitude for our family and for Jim and I, for sure.
And thus, of course, the subtitle of the article highlights hope and gratitude as life essentials. It sounds like you live by this mantra. I'm curious, if you were to post a photo today, what would it be and why?
I would say I'm still grateful for the same things, but it always comes down to my support system. And I would say like my village, that is my family for sure. But, you know, we lived in California and we moved back after that to be very close to my parents, and my parents live in walking distance from us. They nannied our children. They were really involved and so close to my kids. They still are helping driving to school after all these years. My sister lives nearby with her kids, my brother and my sister-in-law with my daughter's best friend, who is her cousin. We moved back to be with family because we prioritized it differently after going through this health scare. And I think that that is still the same. It's my village because I'm allowed to do all the cool things I get to do because I have support. And I think my children are grounded because they have this sense of psychological safety that no matter what, there's a grandparent or a aunt or a cousin or someone that's there that has their back if they need it.
That's beautiful. So is this what led you to speaking, your life's calling?
That's all sort of jumbled together, because after the Smile Epidemic, we ended up starting up a tech company called Plasticity Labs, and it's the idea that I mentioned, that the neuroplasticity of a brain is similar to the plasticity of an organization. You can feel culture when people are just behaving better and kinder and with more altruism. And when we sort of lose that, you create a network effect, and it maybe happens at the few of the leaders and then it trickles down. But then that contagion spreads. And we also find that it spreads positively, you know, too. It can spread negatively. You can have toxic cultures, but you can spread it. Like happiness is very contagious. It's a very contagious social network. For me, I think that was maybe one of the biggest, most exciting research that I landed on, and Jim and I landed on, was the network effect of happiness, which is Christakis and Fowler. And it was a Yale-Harvard study of the Framingham, Massachusetts heart health study. And in Framingham, Massachusetts, 40,000 people, 40 years, they found that heart health was contagious. And so they started to try to understand why. And then they looked at social contagions and found loneliness was contagious, depression's contagious, smoking, divorce. This team of researchers came in and mapped on top of that. They found that happiness is highly contagious. And so we looked at that. Okay, well, how do we build those traits that create contagions inside of organizations? And it's really about small micro shifts over time that turn states into traits in organizations. And so that company was really where it started, you know, my writing and a lot of articles. I was writing for Harvard Business Review. The first one that I wrote was Happiness is Not the Absence of Negative Emotions. And it was based on Jim's and my experience, but also on this company that we had built in the Smile Epidemic. then I started talking about all of our thought leadership, all the research that we were pulling from the data we were gathering in the company, working with organizations, and it just started to blossom. And so I would write, and then I wrote books, and then I would talk about those books and talk about the research. And that's really how it advanced. It wasn't a plan. Again, it just, that's just what made sense, because my role was to share and have an impact so other people would buy into the idea that happiness is important inside of organizations.
Let's talk a little bit about this a little bit more. So again, title of the article, You Champion Workplace Well-Being. I found that extremely intriguing. Of course, it's starting to make sense as we're having this conversation and your role as a workplace culture strategist and a burnout researcher. Jennifer, could you give us a little insight as to what workplace well-being looks like, and in what ways can you help organizations accomplish this?
The value of workplace well-being, I feel like, is still yet to be realized, because the way that we are attacking, or not even attacking, or implementing the concept into organizations is really far downstream. And so well-being has gotten a bit of a bad rap. There was a huge amount of investment in it when there was so much turnover in 2020 after the pandemic, and we needed to retain employees who wanted to have more work-life balance, work-life harmony. And what we found in that, sort of within me writing the burnout epidemic and the plasticity company before that, and then now with this latest book, Why Are We Here, I keep seeing this, like this evolution. It's, we're getting a bit closer, but a lot of the ways that we respond to, you know, to strategies around well-being is, are like perks, they're downstream investments. It's like, you know, wellness and is all about physical activity and subsidized gym memberships and, you know, giving people a week off after they're burned out, or Friday afternoons meeting free and things like that. And that is, it'll give people a little bit of reprieve. It might help someone who is has enough energy to go and use the gym. But for most people, if you're not dealing with well-being right upstream, which is essentially managing the stressors. So even like, it's not even a happiness conversation, it's like preventing chronic stress. If we can get further upstream, which is really where myself and my co-founder of Wellbeing OS, which is part of the Global Wellbeing Group, what we do is we really focus on like measuring and understanding and intervening before people feel levels of stress. And usually that shows up in managing workload. That means more fair policies. It's about having better discussions around what those policies should look like with employees before they're built, before they're executed. It's community, having friendships at work and not feeling lonely. It's making sure that people feel that connected to the mission and the values, that they're actually doing work that suits their strengths. These are all things that are actually not expensive. They're free in most cases, but that's where you improve well-being, is just making sure those hygiene needs are met. And then people then can be optimized, which means then they can use the gym memberships. Then they can, you know, listen to Rain on a meditation app for 15 seconds and feel better. You know, then they're box breathing that they're doing is actually working, because they aren't working 70, 80 hours a week with unsustainable workloads. For people in my world, where it's much more academic and science focused, it's about dealing with those upstream issues and preventing them, so then people can be more open to those downstream perks that we spend a lot of money on.
Well, in the article, you emphasize that these pre-COVID workplace systems don't work anymore. Can you share just a little bit more about that? And I'm also thinking, maybe give us an insight or an inkling as to some of the misconceptions and maybe the new realities.
I joke that we are not in the future of work. We're in the multiverse of work. So for any Marvel fans that like understand this, it really is that we have jumped a timeline. Like, we are in a totally different timeline at this point. If you understand this concept of the way that we were on this trajectory of future of work, we would never have this many people working remotely or even hybrid. A lot of what I had been writing in the burnout epidemic before the pandemic was, we need more focus on remote work and having more discussions about it. And then it became the only discussion was, you know, flexibility is all about where. That's really changed. And I think there's this desire from people in leadership positions for us to just forget what happened and jam the toothpaste back in the tube and go back to what it was. You just can't do that. I mean, people's brains have actually changed. The neural wiring is different. We have gone through acute facing of our mortality, and that went from acute to actually long-term. So a lot has changed, and our brains are different, and our expectations are different. We have different psychological needs. We're not as identified with work. We have a totally different attitude at the Gen Z level versus the boomer generation on what work should look like and what it is. We have massive AI adoption that's so fast that no one really knows what the future holds, and there's a lot of uncertainty. So we just can't go back. This is new and it's different, and we need to adjust. And we can't forget that humans are still a big part of the workplace. They still matter. And we need to understand that there's a variable with humans that are different than AI or robots. So a lot of that, like, we need to think about that as different. And I think what leaders really need to do, and not just leaders of organizations, like policymakers, government, everyone that has some power to shape what it should be like in the future of work, but just in the future of our societies, need to recognize that we have declining happiness and people are becoming less and less well. And a lot of that is because there's just too much change happening too fast and people don't feel hopeful. And that really does have to change.
To give it some context, maybe you can perhaps share a couple of myths and truths.
Yes. So one of the myths is burnout is a 2020 problem. I've heard that from CEOs saying, oh, burnout's so 2020. And I'll ask them, oh, how did you fix it? And they said, I'm burned out about talking about burnout. I get that. But the reality is Mercer's trends just said 81% of the workforce this year is at risk of burning out. So it's still very prevalent, even though we don't want to think about it, that people should just, you know, be okay with going back to work. It's a transactional relationship that we have with people. And, you know, you can disagree, but you have to decide, or you can quit. To me, that's a myth that we are going to have AI replace all jobs and we won't need humans anymore. There's going to be a lot of shifts and change and guardrails that I believe are going to be put into place. So this idea of just forcing employees to deal with whatever policy you give them and to kind of shut up about it is very short-sighted. I think the reality is, the truth is, humans are going to be more important than ever, especially as we're in this evolving workforce. They need to know how to work with AI. We're going to see a lot of mature workers leave and Gen Zs opt out. That's a myth that we're going to be able to run our businesses solely on AI. And then I also think that it's a myth that happiness at work doesn't really matter, that we shouldn't invest in it, that it's just about, you know, getting someone's job done. And I mentioned that it's just transactional. We've gone from a transactional relationship to a social relationship. If you want workers to be working in these blurred worlds of home and life and taking, you know, your work home with you, you have to expect that employees are going to want the same from their employer, that they need to have protections around that. And they need policies that make it so that they help with those blurred lines and they create some boundaries. We are in a social relationship with work, and it's a myth that it's just all purely transactional.
For me, I love the one where employee engagement is about perks and benefits. It's still, there's so many organizations that's what they believe in. But yet you say in the article, the truth is employee engagement is driven by purpose, trust, and fairness.
That's absolutely the foundation. Is you need trust, is that's the scaffolding. If you don't have trust, your employees are just checking out because they don't believe that what you're telling them is true. They also won't go to battle with you. This is a big part of hope and trust, is you know, you want everyone to be all on board for a shared vision. But then on the other hand, you're loudly laying off people and talking about how AI is going to take over all these jobs. How are the people there going to innovate? They're worried that they're going to innovate themselves out of the job. So you need to build trust by making a plan for the people that are there and making them feel like if they're innovating, it's not to become obsolete. We're seeing a lot of that, a lot of detachment. Gallup calls us the great detachment right now from work. People don't have that loyalty or that identity. So they're going to leave when the cycle changes because this is cyclical. This always happens. We have shifts. We have employers in power. They have the ability to improve policies or take away policies. But then we get to a place where there's a talent crunch. And then suddenly they're throwing everything at employees who have the power again. I wish we could just focus more on, you know, on doing well and you do well and you do good. You know, these are the things that can happen. They're not a, it's not an either or conversation. You can have well-being and you can have prosperity and growth and competitiveness. And I think we look at investment in well-being as some sort of benevolent strategy, but it's actually just a smart business strategy because all the data shows that it just leads to all of this, these great business outcomes. Again, there's a short-sightedness that I think is unfortunate. And it's becoming even more short-sighted lately because these cycles are so fast.
Yeah. I'm thinking that a lot of these ideas, these things that you've come up with can apply to regular organizations, but also for nonprofits. And I'm wondering, Toastmasters clubs, it's no secret that the pandemic has taken toll on a number of Toastmasters clubs. Is there any piece of advice that you could offer for clubs when you were talking about an organization where everyone's a volunteer?
I think what is so critical to get across right now is that the number one skill, according to the World Economic Forum, year after year, the most highly involved number of subjects, number of data points, research studies continue to point that analytical skills and creative skills are the most important asset to any human being in the workplace right now. And that's what Toastmasters does. It builds up this ability to be able to communicate those communication skills, to be analytical, to be quick on your feet, to have psychological fitness, to have resiliency. These are skills that every organization needs. So we just need to get more people to understand that the ability for you to learn to develop that, and it doesn't mean necessarily that it's about being a public speaker as the end goal. The end goal is to develop skills so that you can, you know, use them in this highly competitive environment at work and across the workforce. For me, it's just communicating that it's, you know, it's not just this end goal. It really is for continued value in a world where this is maybe the most important skill you could have. And I know that in these worlds where you want to, you know, where you're taking on a lot and you're doing it because you care, just making sure that you're also managing your own capacity and resilience and know that, you know, you're doing good work. And sometimes we need to give ourselves grace for that. Yeah.
Jennifer, this is definitely some sage advice. And folks, if you've found this information quite valuable as much as I have, I encourage you to share this episode with your friends and family and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And Jennifer, before we leave, I'm going to mention that the award presentation will be made at the International Convention in Vancouver, Canada. It'll be live and live streamed on Saturday, August 22nd at 10 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time or UTC-7. You know, of course, check your clocks. And you'll also be doing a presentation called Why Are We Here? Creating a Work Culture Everyone Wants. Could you share with us just a little bit about what people can expect from that?
Yes. So this is based on my latest book. Harvard Business Review Press publishes my books. And I was writing really about this shift out of the pandemic and some of the things we talked about, just the changes that had happened. And it was based on this concept of mortality salience and that when you face your mortality, everything changes. And the whole world went through that, whether it was immediate family or secondary or even just seeing it on the news, what happens to our brains, it completely changes how we think of time and how we think of our life and how much shorter our life is. It becomes a subconscious response. And that makes us want to leave legacy. It makes purpose at work even more important. And it also can make people really shut down. So it can work in both ways. And we're seeing that where people are shut down and they lack trust and they are pushing against policy. They're showing up to work actively disengaged. And then there's a whole group of people that want more, but aren't getting it. This book and the talk really focuses on these 8 leadership traits, these psychological fitness traits that we need to embed in the organization with the foundation of hope and purpose and community. And then we talk about big business challenges like compassion and like AI and how we adopt it and how we think about adopting it and how we can do that better and openness to generational gaps. And we talk about belonging and recognition and how that fits into getting to a shared vision. So it really is what we need to think about differently based on our whole minds, bodies, brains changing over the last 6 years. So I dig into that and I really try to do it in a way that's changing culture in 20 minutes or less. Like I said in the podcast title, it's about small changes. And I have, you know, a real focus on giving people tactical strategies that are 20 minutes or less. It's about micro shifts. It's not a big nebulous thing where you're making a value change or an overhaul. It's what we can do as individuals to affect the system, what managers and leaders can do for their team and for themselves to also affect the system, and how to do it quickly and effectively and most optimally.
This sounds like a session that's not to be missed. And Jennifer, if someone wants to find out more about what you do and find out about your books, what's the best way for them to reach out?
Jennifer-Moss.com.
And folks, don't forget to check out Jennifer's profile in the May 2026 edition of the Toastmaster magazine, once again entitled Golden Gavel Recipient Jennifer Moss Champions Workplace Well-Being. 2026 honoree highlights hope and gratitude as life essentials. Jennifer Moss, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, and I guess we will see you in Vancouver.
I'm so thrilled that we got to talk here, Greg, and I can't wait to be in Vancouver for this event. It's going to be really special for me, so I'm glad I get to share it with all of you.